This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I mean, what's that football fluke is doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team.
I would be very careful about sling.
Am I going to get sued?
You got legal on this?
Let's send you out on the right note. PFF sucks. Have a great day, everybody.
Wow.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Pelizzolo, Sam Monson. We're live on YouTube today talking NFL draft because it's draft season. Sam, we have a very special guest coming up at the end of the show, too. Josh Lucas, who was the director of player personnel for the Chicago Bears from 2015 to 21. And he was in the room for Mitch Trubisky, that draft pick, the Justin Fields draft pick in Chicago. So we're going to go into some of that with him later.
Yeah, not just in the room, but, you know, a big part of the decision-making process. Obviously, yeah. It's a collaborative thing. It's no one person's opinion doing the thing start to finish, but he was part of the whole thing. Like, he was an evaluator.
Yeah, I wasn't implying that he was just sitting like a fly on the wall.
That's what it sounded like.
But he was in the room as in part of the decision-making process. He was in there. So we're going to hear from Josh a little bit later on. And, of course, that's timely as Caleb Williams is the likely number one overall pick to the Bears. And, you know, we all want to know if the Bears are going to solve their quarterback situation forever, you know, finally. So we'll talk to Josh a little bit later on. But first, we got mailbag. We've got some great questions that have come in. I also want to remind people, I am trying to tell Sam we need to do a watch-along for the draft.
Yep.
And I'd like to know which draft we should do. I'm in that 11-12 range, like 2011, 2012. range. That's where my mind is.
11 would be interesting because everyone out of that draft is like a Hall of Famer, so yeah. It would be fun for that reason.
So 11 would be good. Hopefully,
the quarterbacks.
We got to find a good way to be able to do that. You know, again, do we put it on?
Yeah.
With the audio, and then we talk over it. Do we pause the audio and react? I don't know how the best way to do that would be.
No, neither do I. This is one of those things where I will sit in the chair. Everything else is you.
You just want to show up.
Yeah.
How are you not interested in the retro draft? I just went back. I started 2002 last night. You can see my Twitter thread going through the 2002 draft. People love it.
Yeah. I'll be interested, you know, once we're watching the thing happen. I don't want any part of setting it up, deciding on it, arranging how it's going to function. Just give me a chair, point me to the chair, and a screen.
Okay.
That's all I want.
Tyler, can we point him to a chair and a screen and get this going for the 2011 draft? So I definitely want to do that soon. So, are you ready to get into some of the mailbag here?
Yeah, we also have to apologize for being 30 minutes early. You know, we're
usually yeah, it's a weird day. So here's what else we have coming up. Tomorrow we're going to do an offensive line show. So we'll go through all of the top offensive linemen tomorrow, and we're going to have special guest Ramon Foster, former Steelers offensive lineman, former PFF hater, now friend.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of those people. You could be that, too. Maybe you're a hater.
Glad he's a friend.
You could be our friend now, too.
He's a big guy.
He's a big man. He's not as big as me, but, you know.
I mean, he might be as heavy as you.
He's probably stronger.
Yes. I would imagine. If I was putting money on it, I would say he's definitely stronger.
I mean, that was part of his job description.
Yes.
As an NFL offensive lineman. But we love Ramon. He does. He's in Nashville doing Tennessee Titans radio. So we're going to record with him today and get all of his offensive line takes for tomorrow. So tomorrow's your O-line. It's your trenches show.
Yep.
Tomorrow. So we're on a little bit early today to make sure that we could fit all those pieces in. So we appreciate you, joining us early.
Mm-hmm.
Have emails come in?
They have. You want me to break out an email?
Yeah, let's
an email or two.
Let's start. I mean, well, I'll answer questions from the chat. I'm in a good mood. Let's get going.
Good mood. All right. So this one came in from Dennis Keister, I believe is how that is. Well, I don't know, but that's how it suggests it's pronounced. Sam and Steve. Detroit drafted for positions of need in 2023. Instead of taking the best player available or drafting the more expensive positions, quarterback, receiver, tackle, edge, corner, etc., Detroit made it to the NFC Championship game. In your view, using hindsight, did Detroit make the right decision in the 2023 draft? Did Detroit prove anything? For example, to win now requires teams to fill holes now, whereas to win in the future requires some of the expensive players, high-value positions, to be playing on rookie contracts. Also, do you see a future point when Detroit will be in a difficult position because of how they drafted in 2023? Do you think Detroit's 2023 draft and results will cause other teams that want to win now to leave the reservation in the 2024 draft?
It's a good question. So the top four picks for the Lions, remember, were Jahmyr Gibbs, running back.
Yep.
Jack Campbell, linebacker.
Yep.
Sam Laporta, tight end. And Brian Branch, safety slash corner, nickel, whatever you want to call it. So I would say, did those all fill positions of need? Gibbs did, not from the perspective of they needed a running back, but they needed an explosive running back because they'd already signed David Montgomery. Jack Campbell did not actually fill a position of need. He stepped onto the depth chart as the fourth linebacker. They were actually very deep at linebacker.
Yeah, I mean, I think my initial reaction to the question is, I don't agree with the premise that their first four picks were picking areas of need. I think
there's some truth to it, though. I'm trying to go through all the picks to describe whether or not they were.
Yeah.
So Gibbs, kind of a need. I would say Campbell, not a need. I would say Sam Laporta at tight end. They had Brock Wright, right?
And yeah, they had traded away Hawkinson.
They had traded, yeah. So I'd say that was a need. That's fine. They needed a three-down tight end, say. And then Brian Branch, did they need a nickel? They had just signed
Chauncey Gardner-Johnson,
right? So it wasn't really a need. It actually felt redundant as a pick. So I would say two out of four.
They brought in, remember, that offseason, they had brought in Sutton, Mosley, and Chauncey Gardner-Johnson to effectively eliminate the need in the secondary, which wasn't to say they weren't going to draft anybody, but it meant it was no longer a need. Like, they had actually removed the need with the free agent moves so that you could have the flexibility to go and draft different positions, and then they end up drafting a guy for that position anyway.
So the basic premise, I don't think they just went and checked needs off.
No.
And then the idea that, okay, you can copy that, I don't think, you know, I use the phrase all the time, there's a difference between strategy and a prayer, right? Strategy and like a hope, right? Which is the idea that, hey, we want to get pressure with our front four isn't really a strategy, because you need a front four who are all really good pass rushers. And any team would want that. The bigger thing is the actual evaluation of those four players who are rushing the passer. So I think that's what happened with the Lions. Jack Campbell wasn't great this year, but the other three really were. And I think they're going to hit at the end of the day on all four players as players. So I think that's the bigger thing, right? They found four good players. And I bet if you ask the Lions, and in not just the post-draft talk, hey, you know, you took this guy and you took that guy, they would say, yeah, we trusted our board, right? We didn't reach. Even though people expected Jack Campbell to go, say, in the 30s or 40s, and they took him at 18, they took the best guy on their board, right? So I do believe that they would tell you that. I don't think they sat there and said, yeah, we're going to fill these depth chart spots. We'll take the linebacker at 18, even though he's 30th on our board. I think they took the best players. So I would say, from our view, I don't know that they filled needs. From Detroit in the building, I don't think they sat there and filled needs. And the bigger reason why it worked is I think their evaluations were good, and they found good players.
Yeah, to me, I don't think the way to frame that draft strategy for Detroit last year is filling needs versus drafting quote-unquote best player available. I think the way to frame that evaluation is high value positions versus lower value positions and good players, right? So that was the interesting element of that draft, is even at the time, nobody, certainly our analysis was not, we don't like the players that Detroit drafted. It was, we like all of those players that Detroit drafted. What we don't like is the value positions that they were picking at specific spots in the draft. So they had two high draft picks. They had two first round picks, and they spent them on two of the lower value positions that it seems to be the way the league operates right now, running back and off the ball linebacker. And then they follow that up with tight end and safety slash slot corner. So to me, the analysis for Detroit is, Okay, some people have been pushing this idea of, you know, the higher up in the draft you are, the more you should lean towards higher value positions. Whereas Detroit seemed to approach this as, we're just going to grab the guys we're the most confident in are good football players. And if it happens to be at a low value position, we don't care. Like, that appears to have been their approach last season. And at least initially, it paid incredible dividends. Sam Laporta had maybe the best rookie season a tight end has ever had. Jahmyr Gibbs made a material difference to that offense, was an explosive playmaker when they played him at running back and sort of forgot the other stuff. Brian Branch came in, was an immediate upgrade as a slot corner. And then the only one that didn't really make a big impact was Jack Campbell as their off-the-ball linebacker. So that is the... If there's a takeaway from that class, if teams are looking at what Detroit did last year and sort of saying, should that influence what we're doing this year, it's, you know, we have a couple, like teams that have maybe a couple of first round picks or teams that are just well positioned in the draft. But, you know, everyone's saying we need to pick a wide receiver, we need to pick an edge rusher, we need to pick, you know, the high value positions. Do they just say, look, we're just going to grab the guys that we think are really, really good, we're most confident in being good football players? It doesn't matter if it's this high. So that's where, you know, we had this debate with Bijan Robinson. We had this debate with Kyle Hamilton. I think this year, the two guys that debate should be surrounding are Jackson Powers Johnson and maybe Graham Barton, depending on where you want to play him. Like, these are two guys that we should be asking, how high can you draft them, as opposed to, well, it's only a center or a, you know, an interior guy. We don't take those in the top 10 or whatever. Well, if you're that confident he's really good, why not? Like, if you have a need at that spot, it's not a good draft for those interior players, and we think they're really good, why can't I draft them at 12 or whatever?
So I would say a couple thoughts on this. By the way, if you did want to look back at the draft for need strategy, the one off the top of my head that was very extreme and worked was the 2020 Bucks. So they had just signed Tom Brady, and they, you know, they bring in Gronk and the whole thing, and the Bucks went into the draft with no right tackle and a starting safety position open. And the Bucks basically said, okay, there was four tackles being talked about as top 10 caliber tackles. There was Andrew Thomas, Jedrick Wills, Mekhi Becton, and Tristan Wirfs. And the Bucks were sitting there at pick 14 or something like that. And they spent the whole first round, they tried to get up as high as 7. I think they got up to just 13. Like, they just traded up one spot to 13, I believe it was, to take Tristan Wirfs. Just because they said, we need a tackle. We need to fill this right tackle spot. And Tristan Wirfs goes in and is an outstanding rookie right tackle for a Super Bowl winning team. The second pick was Antoine Winfield, steps in immediately as a starter for the Bucks, is a very good safety. That's actually a strategy that I think was on the extreme end of filling needs. Now, again, if you asked Jason Light in Tampa Bay, he would probably tell you, well, no, Tristan Wirfs was a top 3 or 4 player for us. And yeah, we had Winfield. We had a first round grade on Winfield and got him in the second. So say what you want. I don't know. But that felt like we filled needs and then went and won a Super Bowl with it when Brady came in, and we made sure that we had most of our needs filled in free agency. But we had these drastic holes on our starting roster, starting lineup going into the draft. The other thing I'll say is, I trust my draft model, as you know, Sam, and I've tested it agnostic of positional value. And I've gone in and said, well, what if I just took the best running back, if I really just took the best player on my board in every round historically, regardless of position, running back, defensive line, it doesn't matter. I mean, for me, it worked out over time as far as being bringing more wins to the table than, say, the average draft from the NFL or even the best drafts from the NFL. I mean, that it worked that well. So there's a part of me that thinks if you really do have an edge from an evaluation standpoint, it doesn't necessarily matter over time. But you also would want to hedge a little bit because it comes down to the finances and scarcity, right? So when you talk about positional value, I tweeted this stat the other day, right? Edge rushers. Where do edge rush starters come from? 61% of first rounders become starters. Only 25% of second rounders become starters. Now, if you don't want to use starters, use solid players or whatever you want to call it. It's drastic. 30% become solid by my numbers here. 0% in the second round. I mean, that's just, you find your best edge rushers in the first round. And then at the end of their 4 years and 5 years, their contract is in line with the rest of the league. It's not drastic. We've mentioned this before, like Jahmyr Gibbs' contract in years 4 and 5 are going to be, or year 5 in particular, are going to be one of the highest running back contracts in the league. So even if he's a good player, it's the scarcity and the contract value issue. Same thing with a Jack Campbell. Is he going to be getting high-end linebacker money at the end of his 5 years? So it's a short and long-term play that you're discussing when you talk about positional value. And it's also a scarcity issue. If I could find a starter in the first round, fine, but can I also find that same caliber player later in the draft?
Yeah, it's an interesting draft class because I don't think there are that many of those really good players at low value positions where you have to ask that question, you know, the way we're asking it for Hamilton or Linderbaum or the running backs, Bijan Robinson or whatever. When you look at the first half of the first round, it's difficult actually to find a landing spot for interior offensive linemen. It probably starts the window at 16 for Seattle. It's not that the teams in the top half don't need offensive linemen, but the ones that do tend to need tackles as well. So they're probably going to focus on tackle. Actually, the player that to ask the question about is Brock Bowers. So
yeah,
one of the top 5 players in the draft, maybe by sort of position agnostic big boards, but he's a tight end. And we've just done this dance already with Kyle Pitts, and that hasn't necessarily worked out amazingly. But Brock Bowers is the guy where if you're like Detroit's strategy last year being played out this year would have a team drafting Brock Bowers in the top 10, right?
Yeah.
He might not go in the top 10. He might, I mean, we had him slipping all the way to 18 to Cincinnati the other day in a mock draft, right? So Brock Bowers is the player where if a team is looking at Detroit last year, the lesson from Detroit's draft strategy would be, we need a tight end. Brock Bowers is amazing. I don't care that he's a tight end. We're drafting him at number 10 overall if we're the New York Jets, or number 5 overall for the Chargers because we need offensive weaponry. Like that would be the lesson.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting one because I think some teams will look at Bowers and say, well, yeah, he's an unbelievable tight end. We don't see guys like this before. Therefore, he's going to go in the top 8 to 10, whatever it might be. That was a good question. I thought we gave a thorough answer.
Yeah, that's the idea.
If you have a family like I do, then you need to get term life insurance to protect them. That's right. It's one of the smartest financial decisions you can make. And this is the best time of the year to get it done so you can focus on whatever else the year has in store for you. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget, like $1 million in coverage for less than $1 a day. Get your personalized quote in just minutes, and then apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You can go from start to coverage in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. So join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Man, we used to have a really good terms and conditions guy at this company, but
yeah,
he gone.
No longer. You ready for the next question?
Yeah.
So this one is essentially, it's a Vikings-related question that has 3 different parts that are all related to trades this year. From Mike. If you can discuss, not your friend Mike, just a different Mike.
Not Mike, not my buddy Mike.
No.
Okay. Just Mike, so it wasn't you. But you could email us, though, if you wanted.
Yeah. Number one, is it possible that the Vikings have put in a call to all teams picking in the top 10 to let them know that they will beat any offer to move up? Minnesota simply has much more trade ammo than the Broncos or the Raiders. This would allow them to let the market decide if they need to trade up as opposed to guessing. Realistically, I don't see another team being able to match what the Vikings can offer. Number two, if they move into pick number 5, I don't see how they would need to give the Chargers much more than picks number 11 and 23. They're 2 first rounders. That's basically a first round pick for this year to move up 6 spots and select the 4th best quarterback. I understand quarterbacks come with a premium, but a 2025 first rounder on top seems like complete overkill. Not to mention, I believe the Chargers are far from ambivalent here and really want this deal to happen too, i.e. they're desperate to trade out. Number 3, I don't think it's worth discussing a Viking-Cardinals trade. Based on free agency, Arizona seems to be certain they're drafting a top wide receiver, and I don't see how that remains true if they trade back to number 11. Marvin Harrison Jr. seems like a perfect fit there, especially with the optics of them acquiring a new legacy wide receiver like they had in Larry Fitzgerald. The runway seems to be cleared for a top wideout to be added, plus in a vacuum, the Vikings do not need to go beyond pick number 5 for McCarthy. Thoughts?
I feel like the first question's from a professional negotiator. He's he's seeing the whole the big picture, right? You're sitting. The question was essentially the Vikings have the best ammo to move up.
Yeah,
they hold two first round picks, so they call every team in the top 10 and they say, "Send us your best offer. We'll top it." And if they don't get a call back, they're like, "Oh, we'll sit at 11. We'll get our guy."
I mean, I think, yeah, from a process standpoint, at the very minimum, they should be telling every team from 2 to 5.
Yeah, we're
six.
Willing to. What would it take?
Not even what we're like. We're okay, willing to top explore it. The trade, but also, yeah, like just telling them don't take an offer before asking us to beat it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like just get yourself and because. There's no reason any team sitting there in that range wouldn't make that phone call, right? Yeah. You see that in these post-draft videos that come out all the time, right? Where there's a team trying to work a trade and there's someone else on the phone, like, well, go see if they'll beat it, and they don't or whatever, and the trade gets happened. Like, there would be no reason for them not to make that clear to every team that's potentially going to move, right? If you're fielding phone calls, don't take a deal before calling us and seeing if we'll do better because we have more ammunition than most of these other teams. We went and got the second first round pick. We got 23, you know, to do this. So, yeah, I think number one, I'm sure that's happened that they've said to all those teams, don't make a deal before giving us a shout because we can potentially do better. The number two one, do they need to give up more than 11 and 23 if they trade into the Chargers pick? I mean, ultimately, it kind of depends what else is on the table, right?
Yeah. But again, I don't know if any team – so if another team comes up – so the Chargers are sitting at 5, and let's just say it's the Broncos.
I also don't know, by the way, that the Chargers – that I mean, this the Chargers being desperate to trade out of that pick was sort of pre-getting rid of all their receivers. Now they're kind of in the same boat that Arizona is, which is – we don't have a receiver anymore. Our top guy is Quentin Johnston, and even if we're pivoting to a Harbaugh run-heavy offense,
you still want a good receiver.
We still need somebody to throw the ball to. So I don't know that they're that desperate to move out anymore.
They're not. But the debate here is okay. Minnesota has 11 and 23. If a team like Denver sitting at 12, Denver offers 12, and all they can offer is next year's first rounder.
Right.
So if you're the Chargers, you would say, okay, I'll take 11 and 23 this year, unless you're just going to gamble that, well, the Broncos are terrible and we're going to beat them and there'll be a top 10 pick again next year and we'll be patient and wait. Maybe they would want to do that. But I really think that the blue chip debate is one that happens in buildings, right? Where if you're sitting at 5 and you want to get one of those top 3 receivers, assuming they have similar grades, or you want to get the top tackle, which is, you know, if it's Joe Alt. You know, you're having that debate, and you don't want to go down too far where you lose one of those guys. But the Chargers could easily have this conversation and say, well, do we need receivers? Yes, it's a deep class. And so the debate would be like, we could take one Marvin Harrison Jr. or Malik Nabers, or we might be able to get, say, Fashanu or Fuaga at 11, and then Brian Thomas Jr. at 23. Take your personal evaluation of Brian Thomas Jr. out of it. Wide receiver 4 could be available at 23. That might be attractive for the Chargers. We could have two starters or one elite receiver. Would they take that?
But I don't think that the limiting factor here is not necessarily does Minnesota just need to beat Denver or the Raiders, right? Like the fact, like if you look at it in a vacuum, pick numbers 11 and 23 theoretically get you to 5 pretty much dead on in terms of the Jimmy Johnson trade value, et cetera. And that's more than Denver can offer effectively, right? I mean, they can offer more, but they need to do it in a way that seems overkill. You know, if it's a better deal than 12 plus next year's first rounder, which is the sort of standard, what you would assume Denver's deal is starting with. But just because they beat Denver's deal doesn't necessarily mean that's all they need to give up, because the Chargers can effectively say, look, this is a deal you can make happen. There's no guarantee that you can make a deal happen, the same deal happen for pick number 6, 7, 8, you know, 9, whatever. Like the further you go down, now you're making it easier for Denver to get into one of those spots. So they might beat you to the next pick, or those teams might just not want to take the deal, right? So just because on paper picks number 11 and 23 get you to 5 doesn't mean the Chargers can't also squeeze an extra draft pick out of them, because the Vikings might not want to run the risk that they can make a deal happen with somebody else.
Any predictions on how it ends up going down?
Oh, so and then the third element of this was Arizona, right? Yes, Arizona might not want to trade down from where they are and miss out on a top wide receiver because in theory, going down to number 11, you might miss out on the top three.
Right.
You might be down to wide receiver four at that point. And I do think that everybody views this as a big three, then a gap, then wide receiver four through whatever, however you have them ordered.
And,
right?
And as the Cardinals, you already have two first-round picks. So do you need, you know, it's nice coming out with three first-round picks. Those years are fun.
Yeah.
But are you content with, hey, we've got two first-rounders. One of them is the best non-quarterback in the draft. We're good with that.
So you could do that, but also they've already done this. What if they trade down and then come back up for a receiver?
And come back up.
So this is the thing. Like Arizona might be open for business, and maybe they don't want to trade down to 11. You know, ideally they would want to trade to whatever, 6, 7.
Yeah.
If that's not on the table, Arizona might be willing to trade down to 11 and then try and jump back up for one of those top three receivers, right? Now, and they might only need to trade up to like 11. Or sorry, to like 9, right, from 11. What if Chicago is sitting there at 9 and Arizona says, okay, we'll give you something to move up 2 spots, you drop down 2, and all you miss out on is the luxury pick of Odunze as your third wide receiver. You could drop down 2 spots and just pick a different position instead. Like, for Arizona, that might be the way they would do that deal.
As an aside, I think if you were reading the buzz for quarterbacks and their connections with teams, correct me if I'm wrong on this, are you feeling the same thing? Jaden Daniels to Washington seems to be heating up more and more over the last few weeks. J.J. McCarthy as a Patriot or a Viking. So either the Patriots at 3 or the Vikings coming up to get J.J. McCarthy. And then Drake May with the Giants. And I think the more you talk to evaluators about Drake May, he seems like the one where people would love to have him sit for a year. I think him or J.J. McCarthy, people would love to have sit for a year. J.J. for general experience, and he's young, and May's young, right? And May is young and has specific footwork issues and quote-unquote easy stuff issues, missing layups that people would love to iron out. So the Giants could be the perfect spot for Drake May at 6. So that's what I'm feeling as far as like those top teams and where they might fit. And then that puts the Raiders and the Broncos and the Vikings, right, as the three teams. You know, if you love Drake May, do you have to get ahead of the Giants? If you love J.J. McCarthy, do you have to get to 3? If you loved Jaden Daniels, would you have to get to 2, you know, to supersede Washington?
I mean, there was a report recently, I forget where it came from, that said that the Vikings, it was sort of terming it, of all the other quarterbacks, i.e. after Caleb Williams, that they loved Drake May the most.
Yeah.
If you love Drake May the most and the sort of current smoke that's circulating out there in the pre-draft world is accurate, I mean, you might actually have a shot at getting Drake May at 11.
Yeah.
You might not even move anywhere. And if you are, that idea of, you know, how comfortable are you trading up and giving up, you know, a lot, maybe 2 first-round picks, maybe 3, to get up to 4 or 5 for QB4. But if QB4 is actually QB2 on your board, you feel better about it.
Yeah.
So this was, like, that's where this gets interesting is, you know, there will be a consensus ranking of these guys that goes Caleb Williams number 1, and then the next 3, 4, 5 in some order. And if you look at that on a board and say, this team traded up for QB4, feels not great. But that guy might be QB2 on their board. So if they traded up for the second best, what they believe is the second best quarterback in this draft, you can argue that, look, nobody's good enough to make that determination. But it does change how you view that trade, right?
For sure.
You traded up in theory for the second best guy, not the 4th.
Yeah. And no matter what you traded up for at the press conference, you're going to say, oh, yeah.
Of course. Like, he's the top guy on
our
board.
He's our guy.
Yada, yada.
He's our guy. Really quick, we're going to have Josh Lucas on later. We did not. We pre-recorded the interview. We did not get to ask him about the Mitch Trubisky decision that they were a part of. But I did hear him in other interviews talk about you remember, Bears were sitting at 3. They traded up to 2.
Yeah.
They obviously had Trubisky as their top quarterback on the board. They had good information, what they thought was good information, that another team was trying to get to 2 to get Trubisky. So that's why they traded to 2 to lock it in, right? They were willing to give up that extra pick to do that. And they also went into the draft expecting either Mitch Trubisky or Patrick Mahomes. And, of course, we know how it all turned out. We know in hindsight it's like, you idiots, you picked the wrong guy.
Yeah.
But they were the team that was trying to play that game, right? Let's use inside information to figure out, are we going to be able to get our guy? Oh, no. Might miss out on him at two. Let's go up to two to lock him in. And that's what they did.
We didn't talk about this that much with him, but one of the other things that sort of fits what we've just been talking about, they ended up viewing Justin Fields as the second best quarterback in that draft. So if you remember, like right at the start of the pre-draft process, that was how most people had it ordered.
Yeah.
Trevor Lawrence number one, Justin Fields number two, the rest, you know, in some order beyond that. And then it Zach Wilson emerged as the QB two.
You'll hear him say, though, so just a spoiler alert before he gets here, they may not have been in on Trey Lance, fine. Right. They may have been split on Zach Wilson. So in the building, at worst, Justin Fields was QB three, and he may have been QB two for the Bears in that draft.
Yeah.
And they were sitting at pick 19 or 20 and had to trade up to 12, I believe.
So that's what I'm saying is when you sort of remember how that unfolded, they traded up for what at least apparently the majority of the building, because it got made, for what the majority of that building viewed was QB2 in that draft, right? That makes that process-wise, like, look a lot better, right?
Yeah.
Like, they traded up from lower middle of the first round up to that spot to grab what they believed was the second-best quarterback in that draft, as opposed to he went fourth, right? He was the fourth quarterback taken.
He was fourth quarterback taken.
Yeah.
And, you know, as...
So it's literally exactly the same dynamic as we're talking about. You trade up for QB4, it's like, eh. Yeah. And then that didn't work out, right? But you trade up for what you believe is QB2, it makes a lot more sense.
We're going to discuss this, and we're going to throw it to that interview in a little bit here with Josh. But as he was breaking down what was going on with the Bears in 2021, I did have that flashback, and I had forgotten how uninspiring the Bears' offseason was leading into the draft.
Andy Dalton.
Well, yeah, because every other team, that was the year that Matthew Stafford was traded for by the Rams, and I think, you know, Carson Wentz was being traded for, and all these other teams were making their moves. And every year this happens, like, might be the Raiders right now, this might be the Broncos, right? The end of the musical chairs left the Bears with Andy Dalton, bridge quarterback. And it felt very – and they were picking in the middle of the first round.
Yeah.
So right? That's what felt awful about it. Every other team that needed a quarterback was picking pretty high.
That's the funny thing about it is you forget how – but at the time, as soon as Andy Dalton signed, it was like he's going to get Mike Glennon, right? Remember when they – it happened – this happened, what, 3 years before that?
But the Bears were picking at 19 or 20, though.
No, I know. That's the thing.
We didn't know how that would look.
When Mike Glennon was signed, they signed Mike Glennon and then almost immediately drafted his successor. And it's like, oh, the Mike Glennon era is going to last like 5 minutes and we're on to the next guy. And it was Trubisky. And then when Andy Dalton was signed, everyone was saying exactly the same thing. Andy Dalton's about to get Mike Glennon. This is not – you know, but – so it was so obvious they were going to draft a quarterback in that draft, but they were starting from whatever it was, 20, or where? How far down were they? Yeah, 20. So it was like at pick number 20, people were convinced the Chicago Bears were going to draft Andy Dalton's immediate successor, and he was going to be in the job 5 minutes. Like that's how desperate they were for a quarterback that even though they were picking 20, everyone knew they were going to come out of that first round with a QB.
Brandon Katz in the chat is saying that the Bears didn't trade up. I mean, they did. They traded from 20. Was it 20?
20.
From 20 to 12.
Yeah.
They gave up a future first-round pick.
Right.
And you'll hear Josh hint at this, that the and it's interesting how this goes, right?
Ownership
to 11?
Yeah.
Sorry. The ownership essentially gave them, here's the package that you can offer.
Yeah.
Right, which means, hey, they said we're willing to give up next year's first-round pick, so you guys can go get the quarterback that you want, and they moved up to pick 11. We never got our friend Rick Spielman to answer this too, because the Vikings were in that mix too, right? The Vikings ended up they traded down in that draft and took Christian Darrisaw. But then supposedly they were trying to get up to Fields at some point, and when they couldn't, then they traded down with the Jets, right? And they took Darrisaw.
And they traded down with Darrisaw on the board.
Yeah.
So they had Darrisaw there.
I loved that trade.
They traded down, and they still got him.
Process-wise, I loved that trade, and I know Spielman didn't last in Minnesota more than the extra year. And the two extra picks that they got were like Kellen Mond and then the guard from – was it Wyatt Davis? The guard from Ohio State. And at the time, I was like, oh, you have an upside guard and a backup quarterback. Yeah. This is a genius trade.
Right.
It did not work out whatsoever.
Right.
But they got the same player that they wanted – and picked up two extra lottery tickets, so to speak.
Right.
So, All right, the last email that you wanted to
last email. Send here. This is more of a discussion. So Don Crehan just writes a couple of statements that I was supposed to react to. But anyway.
All he needs at the end is a discuss.
You're right. The longer the ball is in the air, the more the skill needed to make it a completion shift from the quarterback to the wide receiver. Beware of Jaden Daniels.
This is one of those things that sometimes I repeat things and I think that they're my own idea, but somewhere along the way I probably heard it and repeated it. What?
Pretty sure this has been my
I've been saying this for years. I actually remember where I heard it first.
Yeah? Was it from me sitting right opposite you?
No. It was actually from Aaron Schatz. I heard him saying this. And I agree. Like, I think we've always kind of known this intuitively. The longer the ball in the air, the longer the ball's in the air, the more it's a receiver-based skill. And data shows that. It's one the deep ball completion percentage is far less stable than other areas of the field. And so, yeah. I mean, you could be a good deep ball thrower. I think Russell Wilson's a good deep ball thrower, but the actual results are definitely wide receiver driven.
It's a symbiotic relationship. Like, it isn't as simple as deep ball throwers are products of wide receivers. Like, you need the quarterback to understand where to put that ball in the air, but the further he's throwing it, the more the margin for error is massive, and the receiver is the one that can make up for that margin for error. But the quarterback needs to understand how to put a ball in the air that enables the receiver to maximize that margin for error. This is why Russell Wilson has been one of the best deep ball throwers in the NFL throughout his entire NFL career. It's not because he drops the ball into a bucket 50 yards downfield every time he throws it deep. It's because he puts, like, the moon ball that Chris talks about on the broadcast, right? He puts more air under the ball than any other quarterback, basically, when he's throwing deep, which means it's up there for longer, which means even if it's off target, the receiver has more time to go and get in the space where it's about to drop to and make it look like it's an amazing, accurate deep ball. So, and, like, there's so many times where, like, you can have the best deep receiver in the NFL, but you still need the quarterback to be able to give him a chance. And that's why Randy Moss worked amazingly well with any quarterback throwing him the ball, right? Because Randy Moss is maybe the greatest deep ball receiver in NFL history. But it's also why when you added Dante Culpepper to him, it went to a different level versus Randall Cunningham or, you know, Jeff George or Brad Johnson. Like, Culpepper was one of the best deep ball throwing quarterbacks in the league, and the number of times where those two guys hooked up perfectly, where Moss makes a slight adjustment but Culpepper also drops it in a bucket, and together that makes it literally unstoppable. That's what turned that into the greatest combination at the time in the NFL.
A few things off the top of my head as we wrap up this and send it to Josh. Alex Smith led the league in deep receiving deep passing yards in 2017. Tyreek Hill. Tua is now one of the most effective deep ball throwers now that he has Tyreek Hill and Jalen Waddle. Patrick Mahomes' deep ball numbers have gone south over the last 2 years. He's still great at everything, but the actual deep ball numbers do go down. So, yeah, if you're going to apply this to Jaden Daniels, might be some truth there. Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas Jr., are they the ones doing the hard work there for Jaden?
I mean, you can't, at the very minimum, you can't not factor that in. Like, The whether or not it's everything or it's just a massive component of it, you can't simply look at a guy's deep ball, even the tape, like, forget the numbers, even just the tape, and go, oh, look at these deep balls, and not start factoring in what the receivers are doing at the other end of that, which I think a lot of people do. A lot of people simply look at where the ball lands relative to the wide receiver. Look, it landed right in his hands. That's a dime. You're like, well, it wasn't when it left his hand. It only became a dime once the receiver moved laterally 2 yards and, you know, slowed his pace and then extended right at the end. Like, the receiver turned that into a dime. It gave him a shot, but it wasn't the dime you think it was just by looking at where the ball landed.
All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bring in Josh Lucas right now. The show's going to end right after that, so I'll have no outro. This is it. Hey, we love you guys. We'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow's our O-line show. We'll bring in Ramon Foster to break it all down, but right now, Josh Lucas, Director of Player Personnel for the Bears, breaking down Justin Fields, Caleb Williams, all those decisions for the Bears. We'll see you again tomorrow, guys.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, we are thrilled to be joined by Josh Lucas, the Director of Player Personnel for the Chicago Bears, 2015-21. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
This is exciting because we were sitting here in these seats, Sam, a couple of years ago, debating the five quarterbacks in the 2021 draft class and, you know, Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson, Justin Fields and everything. And Josh, you were in the room when Justin Fields was drafted and all the decisions that the Bears made. I've heard you discuss this a little bit. Can you give us a little background on how the Bears kind of landed at Justin Fields, what the thought process was, what you guys were thinking going into draft day, whatever you can divulge, of course.
Well, I'll be perfectly candid. You know, the moment the 20 season ended and Coach Nagy and the GM, Ryan Pace, you know, were not extended and kind of, you know, you're going into your last year. And we knew Mitch was heading out of the building. Andy Dalton was a good signing for us as a bridge, but let's be honest, we had to take a quarterback. You know, we were in one of those unfortunate situations where to save our asses, we had to take a quarterback. Obviously, there was some depth in that first round. I think what most people forget is that 2020 year, we were in the playoffs, so we weren't a top 10 picking team that was going to have the luxury to kind of, you know, move way up in the draft to get any of the five. You know, we backed into the playoffs that year. I think we were picking 19. The ownership president at the time, I think, gave, you know, coach and GM, you know, a parameter of this is the ammo you can use and this is how far you can go up. We were well aware Jacksonville was obviously going to take Trevor Lawrence. It was very well known, I think, throughout the league that the Jets were going to take Zach Wilson. For us, it was Justin and Mac. We didn't have the grades. We didn't have the vision for Trey Lance, you know, as a first-round quarterback in our building. And Justin and Mac had a lot of love throughout the building through various people. You're talking about polar opposite prospects. Couldn't be more opposite. You know, one would win with timing, processing, you know, and getting it out to his playmakers as fast as you can. And one, obviously, a little more methodical, a little bit more of a power deep ball thrower who had rare physical makeup. And that decision literally came down to, you know, the day of the draft. And, you know, as I just mentioned, they both did really well in the interview process. COVID, so there wasn't as much contact. It was a very strange year for as far as evaluating quarterbacks. Everything was Zoom related. But when you just looked at the board the day of the draft and you really just looked at the grades, you know, the building overwhelmingly, I think, was tilted towards Justin. And obviously when you're picking where we're picking, knowing that this is probably going to be a pick that's going to be anywhere from 8 to 15, you know, you're going to get a quarterback who obviously has first round pedigree, has a lot of ability, but there's going to be some question marks on him as well. We had some concerns with Justin on just how methodical he played in the pocket, kind of how slow he could be as far as getting the ball off. We felt really good. We used the S2 score. We were big believers in that score and that component, and he had scored really well on that test as well as some other tests. And we thought he had the time, you know, he could get to his 10,000 hours in the league where that mental process would speed up because he had phenomenal athletic skill that would allow to buy him time. He could create explosive offense with his legs through designed runs, through extended plays. And as time would build up and he got more experience, we thought that processing, getting the ball off quick to your to the original read in the offense would really improve. And that was our kind of vision for the player. Our main concern, I think, was, is this just 2 years starting quarterback in college that needs more time? He's playing around phenomenal talent, offensive line and perimeter skill. He's got more time to operate, or is this like a lack of instinct? And that was our big question. And after 3 years, I would say, I think there's a little bit of an instinct issue there. And it's why I think the league just told you he's viewed as a backup quarterback right now more than he's viewed as a starting quarterback. Tremendous person. I won't bet against him having success going forward because he's always going to be well liked in the locker room. He's always going to work his ass off. He's always going to have those legs to buy him, you know, plays that others can't. He just needs to speed up the process, and he really just needs to trust the offense. You watch the tape. The throws are within his vision. He just doesn't let it go sometimes, and it leads to holding the ball. It leads to costly sacks, and what it really leads to is uneven offense. You know, 1 week, yeah, this is the guy. Next week, oh, he's not the guy. So that's kind of the backstory on Justin.
It's interesting from the outside when you're trying to sort of evaluate the draft. A lot of it is trying to piece together the puzzle of like the consensus and how people view quarterbacks and where the overall body ranks these guys. And when you go back to that draft class, you know, Trevor Lawrence was basically all the way along the consensus number one guy and seen as this generational type of prospect. But right at the start, it was people saying it was Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields. And there were maybe even some questions about maybe Fields has a higher upside than Lawrence and he could be the number one guy. And then quite early on in the process, it was Zach Wilson is now consensus QB2, right? And that became the order. And then it was, now we've got Mac Jones, Trey Lance, and Justin Fields, and figure out what the order is based off your preference. How did that work inside the building? Like, what did that order, did the ranking change over time? Or how quickly did you kind of set on your ranking of those guys? And similarly, like this year, so we all treat it like, you know, it's a moving puzzle, and now you've got the Drake May versus Jaden Daniels versus J.J. McCarthy conversation. Like, how early is this getting set within team buildings, and how did you rank those guys at the time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, going back to 21, and even going back to last year, that S2 score pulls weight, trust me. Trust me, when you had Stroud and Bryce last year,
and you only had, really quick, you only had a couple years of S2 data at that point, right? But it was starting to really
back to like 16.
Yeah.
So obviously last year, a few more years.
So you're looking and you're like Mahomes and Lamar and some of the guys who are hitting were probably high S2 guys as you're seeing this score for Fields come in.
Yeah, it was. It's been very accurate. It's been very accurate on guys that have scored poorly on it, and then Stroud just completely flipped the whole narrative on that. But like, I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I think that influenced some of the draft boards in 21, because a lot of these guys scored really highly on it. And I think Trey Lance is a guy that got boosted up after that test came out a little bit. And then obviously last year, I think people around the league were very concerned, obviously, with the reported score of CJ Stroud. I don't know what he actually scored. That's one small component of it. For us, going back to 21, you know, I think us knowing ahead of time. Now, Trevor Lawrence, that was done. Like, everyone knew that. He didn't even take the test. But going outside the test, going just off of the person and going on tape, it was very helpful for us that Zach was likely going to New York, because I guess I should be allowed to say this. Like, we were not in agreement on Zach Wilson when you're talking coaches versus scouts. And that would have been a major, major, long, drawn out watching tape, and because we were on two different planets as far as personnel and coaching. For us, it really was just the three guys, and you know, we had some guys that liked Trey, but obviously the grades, you know, favored Mac and Justin. So it was, for us, it was pretty nice to just really focus in on two guys, let our coaches really bury in with two guys, and then come up with a final a ranking with those two. This year's class, good luck. You know, I think Caleb obviously does things on tape that is clear as day, separates him from the other three. You know, from an instinct standpoint, from an off-script playmaking standpoint, he's a natural thrower. You know, on platform, 65, 75-yard balls in the air on a dime. You know, backpedaling, throwing funny body angle throw, you know, from his hip 30 yards downfield. Like, he just has freaky ability that other guys don't have. Not to say that he doesn't have issues. You know, you don't love his height. You don't love his hand size. He has to learn to play, you know, within a system, and not just let every play turn into a scramble drill. And those are going to be some habits that are going to be hard to break. But he's got unique talent, in my opinion, as far as the ability to throw the ball, and he's a very instinctual runner. These next three guys, I bet you take the, let's say Bears are taking Caleb. Now you got 31 teams ranking three guys. I bet you those rankings are all over the place. I could make an argument for all three of them to be the second quarterback.
Should like, Michael Penix be in that discussion too? Is it three, you know, or is it four?
I don't know enough about the medical.
Yeah.
Just the tape, to me, I say yes, because if Tua was a top five pick, top six pick, and you look at those two's college tape side by side, to me, it's very similar. Very similar. And I know it's a lot of it because it's coming out of the left hand and it looks similar. But as far as like timing, downfield throwing, like, it is very unique. Both of them have issues with, can they play extended when the play breaks down and it's not timing and rhythm? Can they make a living in the NFL playing, excel in that area where I think Tua has shown he's really limited in that area? I think people have the same concern with Penix. When I group these quarterbacks, he'd be like a notch down from the next three. But, you know, you can – Jaden's got special, special physical traits. His legs are going to buy him a lot of explosive offense. I don't know that he sees it as well as you want from the pocket. I'm hearing people say that he's – you know, he's one of the better as far as throwing on time and processing. I don't see that on tape. I saw a guy that had the luxury of playing 5 years of college football, much more time on task than everyone else, surrounded by tremendous talent, and he has tremendous talent. But there's question marks there. Now, here, the one thing about Jaden is when you get into these mobile quarterbacks, they're going to take shots. They're going to get hit. Durability is going to be a real thing. What I do like about Jaden, even though he's got a light body frame, and this reminds me of Lamar a little bit, some guys just fall differently. Some guys just take shots differently. And when you look at Anthony Richardson from last year, you're talking about a fantastic talent who's got this big, beautiful body that you would think is built for contact. But when you watch him play, every hit looks like a train wreck. And it's explosive, and it looks like it's going to lend to a lot of injuries. Where Jaden, I'm not as concerned about, because he can kind of get down, he can kind of glance off of hits. So I think that's going to be a strength for Jaden. Moving on to JJ, if you want to talk about all four of these top four quarterbacks, he's the only one to me that elevated his program. He went into a college and elevated that program big time. You can make an argument a little bit with obviously Caleb as a sophomore, but let's face it, they were very disappointing this year. Drake May, disappointing this year as far as elevating the program. Lost to Virginia, lost to Georgia Tech. The Miami game, when they came out throwing the ball, I thought they struggled, and then they won that game when they started to run the ball. Even Jaden. They played three teams with a pulse this year, and you know, Ole Miss, Florida State, and Alabama. And he's 0-3. And I know a lot of people want to say it's the defense; they couldn't stop anyone. There's something rare about JJ as far as his makeup and his ability to galvanize those other 10 guys. And that's when you see the multiplying effect. And everyone wants to talk about there wasn't enough load, there wasn't enough, you know, they didn't put enough on JJ, like he was propped up by Michigan. I see it totally differently. And as someone who's followed the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry as passionately as anyone's followed it in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, he changed the rivalry. He won both those games. Go back and watch that tape in Columbus 2 years ago. Those throws he made on third down, you know, the first one on the zero blitz, he won that game. This year, they couldn't get him off the field on third down. Like, there's something special about him, but he's got question marks. The arm strength. He throws at one pace. He doesn't have any touch to his ball. Everything's one speed. There's a lot of question marks there. I'm being long-winded. You can rank those guys. Like, everyone's going to pick a favorite of those three, I think, after Caleb. They all deserve to be first-round picks, but I think all three of those guys are going to have to be surrounded by solid, solid cast of players. Versus Caleb may be one of those quarterbacks that you could drop him into any of the 32 buckets and he'll elevate, you know, he'll be able to play like a high level NFL football.
So that's one of the questions about Justin Fields, his time in Chicago was, you know, was the offensive line intact? Were the playmakers intact for him to succeed? Do you think Caleb Williams and what is in Chicago right now, do you think he has the infrastructure to succeed? I know you're saying, hey, he can elevate wherever he goes, but what are your thoughts on the supporting cast with the Bears right now?
Yeah, the Chicago Bears are sitting pretty right now. You know, Justin did not walk into a situation anywhere near what Caleb's about to walk into. They're on year three of their rebuild. They have done a tremendous job through the draft and through signing free agents on building up both sides of the ball. Very balanced. They've been pragmatic. I think they've just hit on a lot of players. Defensively, they have to add several pass rushers. I think they're pretty complete throughout the back seven. But what Caleb's walking into, you would have to show me number one overall quarterback who's walked into a better situation offensively, especially if they take a receiver at 9.
Right.
I personally think they're going to address the pass rush, you know, at 9 with some of the players that are going to be available there. But even if they don't, they'll find a third receiver. Could be the Cincinnati kid they drafted last year. But with Keenan and DJ, They got two better than average tight ends. I think people don't realize how good that offensive line can be when it's healthy. You know, Tevin Jenkins healthy is a really good guard. The right tackle has a chance to be special. The left tackle is functional. They got running backs. You know, they had running backs last year. Now you add DeAndre Swift, new offensive coordinator. He's good. He's not going to have a ton of excuses of he just doesn't have enough around him. Because day one, he's going to have enough around him. And that is a huge luxury when you're picking number one overall in the draft. Because you go back, Luck's the last number one overall quarterback to take his team to the playoffs. And you go back and look at that roster. They hit on T.Y. Hilton in the third round that year. You know, they drafted two tight ends in the second round that year, and they had Reggie Wayne, you know, still on the team and obviously still playing well. But if you look at the whole cast of characters, you know, I would and that team made the playoffs. Like I said, I think this Bears offense has more talent top to bottom than that 2012 Colts team did. Now Andrew obviously was a special player and was on his way to having a special career until he retired. So there's no guarantee Caleb's going to play to that level Andrew played to, but as far as the situation goes, if you're a Chicago Bears fan right now, I'm uber excited about where this team's headed because they're going to have a lot of good players.
Last question, Josh, just because you mentioned the scouts and the coaches, you know, the personnel department and the coaches kind of battling it out. Do you have any good draft stories historically where there was a battle, personnel versus coaches? Who won the battle and how did it play out?
I just don't want to mention names. Every year there's one. I felt every year there was one or two. And I'll just say this. I've been on the side where I didn't win. We didn't pick the guy that I thought we should pick. And have been right, and I've been on the side where we made a decision, and the decision that was made was right. So I've been on both sides of it. You know, I remember our first draft. You know, I can talk about this because it was a later round pick. Me and other scouts really liked Adrian Amos, especially in the fifth round, and he was a kind of corner safety. Conversion, you know, we looked at him just as a safety, but he had some corner experience at Penn State, and I won't name names, but there were some people in the building that were worried about his toughness to play the position, and there was a nice little long drawn out argument before that pick. Obviously, when it's later in the draft, heads. Calm down and things chill out pretty quickly. You're talking about a fifth round pick. Usually the first round pick, those discussions, and obviously if they get heated, that's done well before the draft. You pretty much know, like, this is our circle of guys. But you're always going to have that every year, especially when there's guys on the board where, you know, regardless of round, the offensive coaches really like someone and the defensive coaches really like someone. And that's when the GM's got it. That's a hard job, you know? And I think what Ryan did really, really well in our 7 years in Chicago was to kind of make sure he kind of kept it balanced, throwing bones to, the offense, to the defense, but this draft stuff's hard. Like, I'm doing a top 10 player thing on Friday on a local podcast. And I was just looking back at past drafts. I'm going to give a top 10 players in my opinion in this draft on Friday. And I already know I'm wrong. Like, go back to 2019 and look at the top 10 players. It's subjective, but look at the top 10 players in the NFL from the 2019 draft, very few of them were taken in the first round. Most of them were mid to later round picks. You look at the Kansas City Chiefs dynasty. Patrick Mahomes, obviously, most important draft pick in Chiefs history, best quarterback probably ever to play, first round pick. But you look at their other Hall of Fame players, Kelsey, not a first round pick. Chris Jones, not a first round pick. Tyreek Hill, obviously did with a different team, not a first round pick. It's hard. You know, go back to the receiver debate of 21, I believe. 20 or 21. I think it was 20.
Yeah, with Judy and Ruggs and those guys.
I thought Jalen Reagor was going to go before Justin Jefferson.
He did.
One pick ahead, yeah.
Like, yeah. How – and I'm pumping my chest on draft day. Like, I told you guys, look at that difference. Justin Jefferson's the best receiver in the NFL. Reagor's, you know – trying to, you know, hang on to job going from team to team. And Pace and Coach Nagy, they love Justin Jefferson. And I thought Reagor, because of the speed, was going to be, you know, special. And I thought Jefferson was going to be more of just like a slot guy. Like, the draft is hard.
Yeah.
And of these four quarterbacks that are taken, we all know, us three, all four of them aren't going to be star quarterbacks. Three of them probably won't be star quarterbacks, and there's a really good chance that only one or two of them are going to be guys that are going to be playing for this franchise, you know, going forward into second contracts. So, yeah, there's always different opinions and fights and arguments during draft time, and that's when the GM's got to do his work to keep everyone as cohesive as possible.
Well, Josh, we appreciate you taking the time. A lot of fun looking back at the Bears, some of their draft picks, and looking forward to what's going to happen with Caleb Williams. So thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.